You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 167, by Dr. Steiner, entitled The Human Spirit, Past and Present, Occult Fraternities and the Mystery of Golgotha, 12 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 7, given on the 25th of April, 1916. Today I want to start once more from matters we have discussed in other recent reflections. I have spoken of the customs of certain brotherhoods and described some of what happens there, in particular illustrating how in various ways the deeper impulses of occult brotherhoods have become an arid shell in modern Freemasonry. Last time I referred especially to the custom that represents burial and resurrection, which basically is nothing other than an Easter ritual. Today, my starting point will be something else relating to these matters. Endeavors within these circles are formulated and expressed in terms of a search for the, quote, the lost word, close quote. It is beyond the scope of my lecture today to go into the details of this, but if, with the means available, one inquires into what is meant by this phrase, one need only consider the beginning of the Gospel of St. John, quote, in the beginning was the Word, close quote. In Greek, the Word was always the Logos, quote, and the Word was with God, and a God was the Word, close quote. This Word, as we have often discussed, is of course not at all the same as what we mean nowadays by word. We can only approach its real meaning if we recall, as we have done in recent lectures, that humanity possessed a primordial revelation in ancient times, a primordial wisdom. If you picture this primordial wisdom given to humankind in its infancy, in ways we have here discussed, conceive of it in its whole scope, and call it the Logos, the primal word, then you will have a rough idea of what is meant by the word, or Logos. And we can say that the wisdom given to humankind in its infancy through the mediation of higher spirits, far exceeding everything we can as yet know today, even in our science of the spirit, has been lost. And it is a fine custom, if a feeling at least is kindled in these brotherhoods, that such a thing has been lost and must be sought again. Of course, it is not found there. For otherwise all those who attain a certain degree within such brotherhoods would be wise, as were those primordial people whom the gods once instructed. If this were so, we would see it not only in those who had achieved certain grades in their brotherhoods, but the whole world would inevitably look different too. But in their ceremonies and rites, something does become apparent that offers a picture of this loss of primordial wisdom and rediscovery of it. Something of this nature must embed itself in human souls, so that they become able, at least, when they pass through the portal of death, pass in turn through the world of spirit, and return again to the earth, to develop an understanding of an earthly wisdom that would be necessary for them, and in fact already is so today. So, the lost word is sought. And basically, all our spiritual science is a search for the lost word. But when this lost word is expressed today, that is, if anything drawn from the science of the Spirit is spoken, along come all those who have grown wise in our time. And in so many fields we have made such glorious progress, and say, fantasy, nonsense, dream, or worse things. But in the first part of our reflections today, since we are alone together here, let us enter into a realm of spiritual science that is capable of deciphering many riddles of human existence. One cannot even say that the knowledge that should be furthered through spiritual science was always so absolutely unknown. I myself have spoken in public about a forgotten tone in modern culture, a forgotten stream, in which lived much from which spiritual science germinates. If we consider the human being today, we know that what our eyes perceive is only the outward aspect, the physical body. The etheric body is alive within this physical body and acts within it. But we won't get very far if we know no more than this, that the human being has an etheric body. If we know this word, and at most, and many think this sufficient, that the etheric body is just somewhat finer than the physical body, more nebulous and luminous, this is not yet much. This etheric body, in fact, is a highly complex configuration. If we consider people as they are today, we find differences between different peoples, don't we? Europeans are different from Africans, who are different in turn from Asians. We have to acknowledge these differences. But if we survey all humanity, we have to admit that despite all the differences, these people of the globe all resemble each other much more than animals do. Even though Europeans and Africans are markedly different, if we consider subtler distinctions, we cannot say, can we, that the difference between them could ever be as great as between a stork and a mouse. Thus, animals are much more different from each other than human beings. Animals belong to different species, whereas the human race is a single species. The most diverse animals exist across the globe. Let us keep this in mind as we return now to consider our etheric body. During life, between birth and death, the etheric body coheres through the elastic power of the physical body. Try imagining the following, something that can't be done, of course, but if it were possible, even a research scientist would be persuaded. Imagine that we could, in an experiment, sunder a person's physical body from his etheric body, drawing out the etheric body, and then also separating out the astral body and I, capital, from the etheric body. No longer governed by the physical body's elasticity, this etheric body would fracture into many small pieces. This etheric body is, in fact, a multiplicity formed of many, many parts, and only coheres because of the elasticity of the physical body. And if we could separate the physical body from them, what would these small parts look like? However strange this may sound to modern, clever people, it is true that these parts of the etheric body would assume forms that approximate to an outspread animal kingdom. In other words, all possible animal forms would appear. A certain part of your etheric body, that of the head, would really shape itself in a bird-like fashion, while the part originating in the area of the larynx would become a very beautiful, almost angel-like animal form, and so forth. Basically, we bear the whole animal kingdom in our etheric body. This is the truth. Our etheric body is the outspread animal kingdom, compressed and cohering through the elasticity of the physical body. In ancient, primordial times, when evolution was at a different stage, the whole human form was indeed distributed across all the many animals. Only if we reflect on this can we grasp the reality underlying Darwinism's much coarser and heavier-handed ideas. Humanity prepared itself by developing as if in the different species of today's animal kingdom separate aspects of what was later to become the etheric body, though the animals at that time were somewhat different from today. Our animal kingdom nowadays is no longer something from which humanity could be derived, but quite different in nature. But the powers that were at that time spread out across this animal kingdom were in a sense extracted and are still present today in our etheric body. So now, let us consider for a moment all that is basically within us. With this animal kingdom, we possess all the instincts, all the diverse animal drives, though now harmonized and placed in an overall context of mutual relationship, through being united by the elasticity of our physical body. We are human beings because we are physical human beings, and we received our physical form from the spirits of form during earthly existence. As physical human beings, we keep everything that is in us in check. Sometimes one or other drive comes to the fore when some part of the etheric body gains the upper hand. Just think, therefore, of the complex multiplicity that constitutes us human beings, and how it is impossible, really, to present such things to people, although it is only by means of them that we can properly understand the world. We can see this on occasion when someone in a moment of sudden insight has an inkling of the truth. There have been such people in modern times. For example, Oken, a pupil of Schelling, had a flash of genius in the idea that the human being is composed of the whole animal kingdom. He did not see this in Darwinian terms. I said last time how illogical modern people are when they develop and discuss Darwinian concepts. No, Oken had an inkling of the truth. It was not yet possible for him to draw on spiritual science to express such things as we are discussing this evening, but he glimpsed something of the fact that the whole animal kingdom is contained in the human being, and he ably articulated this. But he was ridiculed, especially by following generations. After all, what other response can a very clever, endlessly clever person give to Ockham's suggestion that the tongue is an octopus? But what I have just been describing from spiritual scientific research is something that Ockham found through brilliant intuition and wished to present to people. He wished to show that the separate parts, as elaborated from the etheric body, have a connection with the form configurations of animals. For instance, he traced the ear's genesis to a sort of mouse-stork combination, and the tongue to an octopus. Naturally, people ridiculed him. But something that appeared so ridiculous was in fact a premonition of profound knowledge, which must develop amongst humanity in coming times. It will not be possible to comprehend the world's phenomena without such knowledge. People will only be able to judge reality by knowing such things. You see, the spirits of form act primarily upon our physical body. And during Earth evolution, they give form only to the human being. The animals possess their inherited form from ancient moon evolution. And this animal form is, therefore, luciferic in nature, is a form that remained over from ancient moon evolution. What was only etheric back then has hardened. From the spirits of form, we have our outward physical form, whereas our inner nature is less subject to them. In other words, the spirits of form work less upon our etheric body than do the spirits of personality, the spiritual beings we refer to as archangeloi or angeloi. They act upon the etheric body and have something to do with governing this multiplicity in the etheric body, which I spoke of. And if we enter into precise spiritual scientific facts, then we must, for example, be very clear that all the powers that originate in the folk soul also act upon and influence our etheric body. What we grasp with our physical body, what we see with our eyes, hear with our ears, is first and foremost international. Qualities of nationality sit much deeper in the unconscious nature of the etheric body, for instance. I presented this here on one occasion about 18 months ago. Briefly, we can see how complex our being is, and that we must seek to understand ourselves in terms of the primordial wisdom that once held sway. And this will offer us deep pictures, insights, and wisdom that are conveyed to humankind and that can be understood if one has the will. Think of the activity of speaking or singing. It is simply a preconception to think that only the physical body is somehow involved and in motion in this activity. The movement primarily occurs in the etheric body, with the multiplicity of which I just spoke. And this is why what comes to our awareness in singing or music surfaces from subconscious depths and is so hard to express in words, because it is connected with the whole complexity of the etheric body. And we can gain a real sense, in turn, of our affinity with the rest of the world when we know that the animal kingdom spread wide around us lives in our etheric body in the way I described. Naturally, if a drive surfaces in us, it must rise into the astral body. These things are not contradictory if we consider them carefully in reality. Thus, in speaking of the presence of drives and instincts in the human being, we must of course ascribe them to the astral body. And yet, they are founded upon the resemblance of form with the animal kingdom, as I have now outlined it. And if, similarly, we could separate out our astral body in the way suggested for the etheric body, it would disintegrate, since it too only coheres through the elasticity of the physical and etheric body. It would disintegrate and would appear as something similar to the whole realm of plants. By virtue of the fact that we possess an astral body, we really do contain all the forms of the plant kingdom we see spread around us in the outer world in such diversity. If you study the whole plant world and the way one plant form relates to another, you have an outward picture, a subdivided picture of what has been drawn together and united in the human astral body. This too belongs to the lost word, in quotes. Primordial wisdom had a sense of these things, and for this reason it was said that there is something in the human being that expresses his deep and most inward affinity with the nature of trees and plants. If you read Norse mythology, for mythologies are in fact only a later expression of this primordial human wisdom, you will discover that the human race is said to originate in ash and elm. And here you find an awareness of the human being's affinity with plant nature, which is due in turn to the fact that the human being was at the level of the plant kingdom during the evolutionary stage of Old Sun, whereas during Old Moon he was at the level of the animal kingdom. And within the astral body, in turn, we bear the actual I, capital. In outward physical life, after all, we know little enough of this intrinsic I. Philosophers, of course, know a great deal about it. For instance, they know that this I as a person perceives it in the physical body, remains constant from birth to death through all the inner soul changes he undergoes. Philosophers know this, and you can read it in countless works of philosophy. It is as if they had forgotten that we always fall asleep in each 24-hour period. Every time we sleep, this constancy of the I is interrupted. But philosophers are not troubled by such thoughts, for they are, after all, extremely clever. When we speak of the I, we speak of something that, for instance, not only has awareness in our waking life, but is also present when we sleep, but then unfolds its powers out into the whole universe, there to be irradiated, woven, and pulsed through by the spiritual powers of the cosmos. We bear this unconsciously within us. And if we could extract it from within us, as we imagined in the case of both the etheric and astral body, we would gain from it the whole picture of the mineral universe with all its diverse cosmic secrets. In this I exists, in compressed form, everything that is spread out through the whole cosmos. Thus we bear the mineral cosmos within us. In this way we acquire a picture of what we really are and of our affinity with the cosmos. And if we speak of the fact that the human being is composed of physical body, etheric body, astral body, and the I, then this should be more for us than mere words. We should recognize that we will only understand what underlies these words if, through spiritual science, we can really consider the whole connection between the human being and the cosmos. Yes, that is an important realm of spiritual science, one people ought at least to engage with a little in our time. Today, people speak about the human being in a very ill-informed way, because everyone is so clever in the modern world. But what they say is very ill-informed. And the times present us with challenges that are too great to be resolved by an ill-informed science and its narrow wisdoms. And yet people are up in arms when you offer them an idea such as the one I have just presented. In fact, it is not a matter of knowing these precise things, but of learning to think in a mobile, flexible way that enables us to discover them. Someone who understands what is happening today knows humanity will face very, very grave tasks and trials in the coming period, tasks of which very few may perhaps have an inkling as yet. But people do not possess sufficient mobility and elasticity of thinking to meet these challenges. If we consider this in direct connection with the severe trials of our time, we can gain a quite different sense of the need for spiritual science to inform human sensibilities in future. The earth is soaked in blood. But in future there must develop on this blood-fertilized earth something that can only be encompassed by a kind of thinking different from what has arisen from the more or less materialistic developments of the 19th century. As you know, the spiritual scientist does not repudiate these developments at all, their importance and their great achievements. But the karma of these materialistic advances in the 19th century has led to the rivers of blood we now witness and the tragic occurrences of our day. People will not, I repeat, find the courage to develop what is needed, even if they gain a fleeting acquaintance with spiritual science or even work on its behalf as far as possible. You see, this spiritual science is strangely ridiculed and mocked in words as fantasy and dream, but do these words equate with the reality? Here I would like to raise something that can show us the depth of lies in which we are immersed today. Let me offer you an example, close at hand, to show how untruthful are the conditions that currently hold sway between people. In one lecture cycle, I discussed Christian initiation, speaking of the first initiation stage called the washing of the feet, a symbolic expression, simply, of something a person should practice inwardly. There, a description was given of how a person should develop certain feelings that support his sense of a connection with all the kingdoms of nature. If we gaze down upon the animal kingdom with deep inward feeling, we must recognize it as the foundation of the human kingdom. What would we, more developed creatures, be if that lower kingdom did not exist? To really enliven this feeling within us is the first step in the first stage of Christian initiation. And then to recognize that the animal, in turn, in a sense looks down from its higher level to the plants, and likewise says, quote, "To you, plant, I owe my existence, though you stand lower than I in the hierarchy of creatures," close quote. And then the plant, too, would feel its way down to the mineral realm from which it grows, to the mineral soil, and say, quote, "To you I owe my existence," close quote. Likewise, the Angeloi look down to the human kingdom in recognition that they owe their existence to us at our lower stage of evolution. And so on, upward through the hierarchies. As we reflect in this way, what we can thus conceive and discover transforms into a fundamental tenor and feeling of the human soul. Our dear friend Christian Morgenstern, who supported our concerns so courageously and faithfully, created a beautiful poem that encapsulates this washing of the feet. In his last collection of poems entitled "We Found a Path," and published after his death, we find these thoughts about Christian initiation in the fine poem "Washing the Feet." Quote, "I thank you, dear dumb stone, to you incline. I owe my plant existence to your being. I thank you, herb and flower, to you bend down. From you I raise my creature power. I thank you, stone and herb and beast, to you bow down. The three of you have raised me to myself. We thank you, child of humankind, and reverently to you descend, for it is due to you that we exist. In oneness and in the manifold nature of all God's being, thanks arise. In gratitude, all life itself enfolds." Close quote. And Christian Morgenstern, whose sensibility lived for many years in our midst, bravely acknowledged in his last book of poems all that flows through our worldview. Naturally, he has not the slightest responsibility for what I now need to express. You see, if Morgenstern still lived amongst us today in physical form, he died 2 years ago, of course, he would assuredly serve our cause today still more powerfully and courageously. But now someone has published a critique of Morgenstern's poems, naturally also containing good things about him, and why not? Back then, before he died, he was already recognized as an important poet, and there is no reason now to forget this. Naturally, the author of the review does not mention that the whole current of this book of poems is deeply connected with our movement. But he does say something else. He cites this poem I have just read to you, and says that it shows how one can have a metaphorical view of spiritual things that is nevertheless devoid of metaphor. The author writes as follows, quote, "There is no picture contained in these wonderful verses, but amidst these free-floating, very spiritual poems, this poem in particular has a special potency because it makes earthly things visible. They are still visible in it. It seems to address reality itself, rather than to be metaphorically conveyed, rendering past earthly aspects of the human journey. Now the human being continues onward, and these verses proclaim it. This admirable poem partakes of this earthly reality, and for my feeling, therefore, is the greatest poem in this book, the greatest that Morgenstern ever wrote, and one of the greatest poems ever written in the German lyric tradition." Close quote. Steiner again. Christian Morgenstern would, of course, be the first to say that this poem of his could never have been written without the whole context of spiritual science, though the critic, Ernst Lissauer, fails to mention it. Morgenstern would, of course, bravely assert that this poem drew on a very particular spiritual context. And here you have an instance of the lies in which we live today, and the way in which people praise the fruits without acknowledging the ground from which they spring. More than this, they praise such work as the finest flowering of cultural life, yet regard the soil it grows in as nothing but fantasy, illusion, and deception. This is what we have to deal with, my dear friends. Truly, I wish I could offer you more uplifting Easter reflections. But our times of bloodshed, make it necessary for us to inscribe deeply in our soul a sense of the karmic conditions in which we now live. These are grave times, and we have to recognize this fully. That is the most uplifting feeling we can cultivate today. We must look reality squarely in the face. Let us look at things in close detail, for instance, examining the capacity for judgment, or rather misjudgment, which we experience every day and every hour, arising from what developed in the 19th century and has found its way into the 20th. Every day we can gather experiences in this domain. I will offer only a few examples of such things. Soon after the outbreak of war, people repeatedly sent me or gave me a poem said to be from Robert Hemmerling's literary estate and regarded as a prophecy of contemporary events. But even a passing acquaintance with Robert Hemmerling's poetry could show that not a single line of this poem could in fact have been written by him. Hemmerling died in 1889. A whole range of newspapers expressed admiration for his prophetic words. Some individuals were singing the poem's praises even when they could long since have realized that it was a fraud. I was astonished, for instance, that Maximilian Harden, in the title Zukunft Journal, started praising this poem so late in the day. Harden resorts to fine words, note the inverted commas, to express his admiration for Robert Hemmerling's exalted muse. A few days ago still, in an evening paper, a leading article discussed the bitter pill, the, quote, Easter pill, close quote, if you like, that we have had to swallow recently. And the degree of seriousness with which this was expressed can be gauged by the fact that this poem by Robert Hemmerling, in quotes, was again cited in the context of such a grave and bitter concern. Here is an example of how much credence we should give to all articles that betray such a capacity for judgment, or rather, misjudgment. And this evening, countless people will believe what they read in their evening newspaper about circumstances in Switzerland, about the political, military, and economic plight of the Swiss. This will all be explained to them. But what I wonder is whether people will look at the author's name and draw some apt conclusions. He is Max Hochdorf, the same man who wrote that stupid article about our movement. I referred to him in a public lecture at the architect's house. Naturally, one will be able to search this article tonight for signs of the same love of truth he displayed when he wrote about us. If we drew the proper conclusions, we would discover how heads are knocked together to drum idiocy into them, how dull-witted and thoughtless views prevail in people who allow such views and verdicts about our age to be hammered home in relation to all contemporary phenomena. To counter this, one has to keep stepping back and seeing things in context. And then we can see how worthless are all the contemporary views of our age that are hammered into people's skulls. Quite a lot is hammered home in this way. It is not too much to expect, really, that people today should have an elementary understanding, at least, of the progress achieved in Europe when we passed from a culture rooted in Norse and Teutonic mythology, though, of course, this drew on primordial wisdom and profound worship of the figures of the Norse gods, to Christianity. An elementary grasp of this would not be too much to expect, you might think. And yet, if you read a journal that has just been published, you find an expression of regret that Norse myth gave way to Christianity. Quote, "The split in our thinking into which we Germans fell through the introduction of Christianity was something unknown to our forefathers. Their views of the world embraced the conflict in nature as the eternal law of life. It appeared quite natural to them. Like the battle between light and darkness, an eternal war was waged between the sons of light and the children of darkness, of good against bad. They knew that their gods were only images." Close quote, Steiner again. Goodness, what nonsense this is! Continue quote. "Through which they grasped the world of phenomena. The world of their beliefs and concerns was at the same time that of their poetry." Close quote, Steiner again. "Such self-congratulatory cleverness." Continue quote. But have we really advanced beyond them today? I fear we have not. And the difficulty of those who cling to old orthodoxies in solving the terrible problems that currently beset us show us only that the roots of our strength lie in the heroic world view of our ancestors. Close quote, Steiner again. In other words, we should reintroduce Wotan and Thor worship as quickly as possible. This journal, by the way, is one that has also published the most insulting attacks on our movement. People today are already having blinkers put on their vision so that they cannot dwell in shades and subtleties that exist between one extreme view and another. The most extreme worldviews and principles are acclaimed and subscribed to. The worldview so trivially called the, quote, in quotes, theosophical, is not free of this general befuddlement, which has assumed very great proportions. This happens when one or another drive gains the upper hand, because a part of the etheric body becomes rampant. And now, after my characterizations today, you can picture this. Pride and arrogance, for example, is something that pervades all written discourse. Each author lets it be known how very important he is. Without this outlook, it is becoming almost impossible to write anything today. As I have often said, esoteric development involves not only recognizing nonsense as nonsense, but the capacity to experience bodily pain in consequence. This physical pain, which could lead one to despair, is something one can very, very frequently feel today when reading various, otherwise perhaps very clever, articles. Here is a small instance. Here I have a little book. I don't wish to say more about its contents. The author is Thomas Mann, whom many regard as one of the most enlightened minds of our day. Here he speaks about how we should regard the causes of the present war. Well, I don't want to go into this much, but he quotes the views of others and says, quote, "Gentlemen, a little courage for mental clarity is required," close quote. He thinks others do not have this courage to perceive and judge clearly. The man is therefore not modest. And now comes the passage that can really make one cry out in pain. He wants to prove where the causes of the war lie, and he says, quote, "War requires conflict between two sides or more. And if Germany had been willing to pursue the highest rationality, even if the other sides had not been, quote, intent on war, quote, as the phrase goes, preferring it to an embrace of German diplomacy, well, the war would not have happened," close quote, Steiner again. Naturally, this is the kind of logic at work in people's minds today. War takes two sides, and without this war, does not happen. This means that if one side attacks, without there being two sides that seek conflict, there will be no war. That's the kind of logic at work today, my dear friends. One accentuated apparently by saying, quote, "Gentlemen, a little courage for mental clarity is required," close quote. The modesty implicit in such statements reminds me of a poem by Matthias Claudius, a fine poem, about supposed humility. I will let the poem speak for itself. It is called, forgive me, The Donkey. Quote, "Naught can I delight in, misshapen and dumb I am, devoid of power and courage. All people pass me by without regard or mock me. I'm neither cold nor warm. There's nothing I can delight in, misshapen and dumb I am." Close quote, Steiner. He's truly humble, you see, continue quote. "I chew on straw and thistles, grow old beneath rough sacks. Ah, nature, when you made me, you were careless. Your only gift to me, a lovely voice," close quote, Steiner again. That is about the extent of modesty you find in people who assert their worldview today. They are universally modest, even in regard to what they feel obliged to learn before they propound their worldview. But they know, of course, that nature did at least endow them with the courage for mental clarity, in the same way, forgive me, that the donkey praises his own beautiful voice. However much such things seem concerned with mundane matters, we do need to consider them seriously. You see, it is far more important for us to acquire the capacity for flexible, mobile thinking than to possess specific spiritual scientific truths. Practicing a strength of clarity in thinking and making this thinking broader and more flexible, as we must do if we are to acknowledge spiritual scientific truths, we will inevitably sense the prevalence today of lies, pride, and all possible things of this nature. They dominate life today. This is not the fault of the broad masses of the population. People who know a thing or two of human life also know that if it was merely up to human nature alone, 2/3 of the population of Berlin would be drawn to spiritual science. It is not the fault of the general population, but is due instead to current conditions and leading individuals. This is something we must be fully aware of. It is not even the leading individuals themselves, so much as the currents in which our age has constrained them, which has led to the belief that any and every one today can form a view about world events without any foundations of insight. It is said that many clever things are written today, but in fact there is much more heat than light. You might even say there's much more coal than flame, if you think of Professor Kohler at Berlin University, who is a jurist and neo-Hegelian. Try giving thorough scrutiny to the charcoal created by such neo-Hegelians. As I said, one has to have an open mind and clear eye, EYE, for what lives in modern culture and thinking. Truly, as heroically as people are spilling their blood, so they would incline to the spirit if this spirit could approach them in the right way. It is not due to the general population. And we can see the signs of this in all the great sacrifices and deeds of ordinary people today. My dear friends, aspects of spiritual science, such as those we have spoken of again today, should give us the will to have an open mind and clear eye for what lives in our surroundings. Recently, I spoke of how people so often speak past each other. I cited a particular example, a groundbreaking book by Professor Schleich, of how people can speak past each other. Do read a few chapters of this book. It really is a good example of how truth is something quite different from human opinion. The really honest inquirers are already working toward each other, tunneling through to each other, as it were, and we'll meet somewhere in the middle. For instance, read the section which ends with a remark about a possible note by Goethe that might one day be found, but which has been extant already since 1892. The chapter is titled The Myth of Brain Metabolism. Read it, and you get a sense of how an honest, serious researcher, such as Schleich, and at the same time a thinker, makes an important discovery based on his anatomical and surgical research, and his duties and work as a surgeon. If you read this chapter, you will see another angle on what Schleich describes. He is actually describing a reality of the head's etheric body. The real facts impel him to describe this etheric body. It will be a blessing to discover that spiritual science is tunneling through from the other side. You see, what mainstream science brings from one direction will get nowhere on its own. Oh, it is painful to see how researchers are digging away from one direction, making as much headway as they can. And yet one has the sense, based on the broad, comprehensive outlook of spiritual science, that although they hold key things in their hands, they do not see them correctly. It is like someone who holds a horseshoe in his hand, magnetic iron, but recognizes only the iron itself and not its magnetic properties. He takes a horseshoe and shoes a horse, well and good, but completely overlooks the other properties of iron. This is how modern scientists approach things. You see, a horseshoe does not actually have to be magnetic iron. It might be better if it weren't. Just think of everything that the discoveries of mainstream science could give rise to if people would really come toward each other with an open, unprejudiced mind. And then think of what actually happens in all domains of life. Research in the field of modern economics is helpless, endlessly helpless, however clever the people who pursue it. They have no inkling of what modern economics might become if they engaged with what spiritual science can offer. It is the same in absolutely every field. People hold iron in their hand, metaphorically, and have no idea it is magnetic, that it contains an invisible power. We must feel this fully. The imperatives of evolution are pushing people everywhere toward the spirit, but opinions are so narrow that they do not recognize or acknowledge it. What we are currently experiencing in the context of modern history and related events is truly a sign of the need to acquire this feeling. And, as I recently said, our time is distinguished especially by the complexity of circumstances and events, and by the fact also that people's thinking cannot begin to encompass them. Everything is fragmenting. Each person finds his own method in his own specialized field, and is unaware that there is an historical imperative at work for all these things to be illumined by spiritual science. Now, I have often said that every physical event has its spiritual aspect. The extent of our affinity with the world becomes apparent when we are given back to the world, when we pass through the portal of death. What I have said about the etheric body relates to the time between birth and death. Things change when, held together still by the eye and the astral body, the etheric body maintains its coherence for several days after death and then returns into the cosmos. Then it exerts an effect I have often described. Many such ether bodies of young people who have recently passed through the gate of death are currently in the spiritual sphere and remain there with all the spiritual content that accrues from a sacrificial death. They can offer help for the spiritualization of humanity in future. But there must also be human souls on earth who understand what hovers etherically around the human being as precious remains of the souls who give their lives in sacrifice. This will be a very real, not merely abstract, process of memory. It will be up to those who remain here on earth to place these powers, available from young ether bodies, at the service of humanity in the way these powers seek. If human souls here do not have the maturity to do this, these powers will inevitably flow instead into Ahrimanic, Luciferic currents. My dear friends, spiritual science shows us not only insights and feelings, but also responsibilities, and they are ones we must faithfully enliven within us. And fundamentally, the right outcome of reflections such as those we have engaged in today, in various directions, will be that we learn to feel the responsibility that the human soul also has toward developments in our time, and the events played out upon blood-fertilized soil. Only when, with genuine, serious feeling, rather than in superficial sentiment, we find edification in considering the connection between the human being and the world, as spiritual science can teach it, will we rightly understand the words that have often been spoken here, and which should remind us of the feelings so necessary to modern people in view of the great events of our time. Quote, "From the courage of combatants, from the blood of slaughter, from the suffering of the bereaved, from the sacrificial deeds of the people, spirit fruit will grow. Will guide souls to awareness of the spirit, to find their purpose in the spirit realm." The end of Lecture 7.